Welcome to the Marshall Pro Podcast. This episode, we have my friend Bill Arbelin, who's celebrating 400 starts with BMW as a factory driver this weekend at Petit Le Mans. Think about a lot of famous drivers throughout history who've earned a special number of wins, pole positions, championships. Fairly rare we can talk about a single driver, 400 races with one manufacturer, not just any manufacturer, a deeply committed one like BMW, just been a part of sports car racing's bedrock for decades upon decades. Give Bill a microphone and there are some great tales guaranteed to follow. That's exactly what happened here. He was definitely in rare form. Just sharing a lot of fun stuff of coming up, being raised by his father, getting into IMSA in his teens in the 1980s, driving small low-powered Mazdas, and then working his way up into a factory position with BMW. And rather than tell you all the things that we speak about, definitely just would hope that you would dig in and enjoy. BMW is celebrating this event, this 400th start this weekend at Petit Le Mans, with some special stuff, the livery for Bill, and obviously making a big deal out of it for himself and the car that he shares with Alexander Sims. They've already won a couple times this year, and Bill is still rocking, kicking a lot of behind. And obviously, if you've done this for 400 races with BMW, that kind of tells the tale all by itself of how effective you've been, how successful you've been, and what an integral part of that program a guy like Bill happens to be. Also, within those 400, which I honestly didn't think about this till my pal Bill Cobb from BMW mentioned, is a start for me. Back in 2006, the 25 Hours of Thunderhill, when I ran a little factory diesel enduro effort for BMW with two cars with Bill, Joey Hand, and a bunch of other great folks, all part of a car and driver effort that I put together. So that little deal there, you know, I think we finished second or third in class, and maybe third or fourth, maybe even fifth overall, whatever it was. But yeah, it was just great to have Bill for a little bit, and as you hear me speak, that guy was an absolute legend to work with, and honestly had nothing to do with his driving skills, just as a human being. Pretty amazing guy. So anyways, it is genuinely embarrassing to know that one of those 400 starts actually came with me. We're trying to think of some other race somewhere he could have done. We could replace that with, but regardless, love the guy. What a star. So, if you're a fan of Bill, you're a fan of BMW, you're a fan of sports cars, or this guy who's been a part of this at the top level, from GTs to prototypes to tin tops for four decades now, good Lord, I hope you will enjoy this. And so off we go with Bill Arbelin at 400 races with BMW.
Well, it means a lot of history. To be a part of such a great team like BMW and so many great teams along the way. Like PTG started my career with Tom Milner, all the guys, Brian Cram. This was a group of guys that Cant was never in the dictionary, and as long as we were in a BMW and those guys could make something happen, we were going to be winning races. And that's what started my whole real career with BMW, and that was the start. 400 races later, in so many different amazing machines. I've seen everything from prototypes in Europe to prototypes in America to M3s to M1s to McLarens, you name it. And I feel 400 races later like I'm the luckiest guy in the world, and I want to get in the race car more today than ever before. I love it so much.
So let's wind the clock back a little bit to the Bill Arbelin who had yet to drive for BMW but was getting close. So I'm sure there are some who followed your career who might not realize you haven't always had a roundel in your heart.
Yeah.
But you did learn with some other manufacturers. Tell me about that guy who was building himself, getting himself ready for a major manufacturer opportunity like this. What was the Bill Arbelin on the cusp of going to BMW?
Well, everybody's path is different. And my path wasn't one that came from a lot of money. It had to be with your hands and your blood, sweat, and tears and doing it yourself. And luckily, my dad's dream was to come from Europe and to race cars in America. And he did it very low level, got with a partner from a Porsche repair shop.
Your dad's awesome, by the way.
My dad is an amazing guy. And, I mean, he still comes to a lot of my races, and we have a great time together.
Heck of a photographer, too, there, Sam Cobb.
Well, he's great, but he's just a great guy. So he raced Porsches, low-level 911 RSR, handmade RSR, not a real one, but and he won Sebring in 1985. I, at that time, was 13, 14, 15 years old, and because we were two or three mechanics working part-time, I was there. I was one of the guys. I was a kid from everything from cleaning the floors to eventually building the engines to eventually building the gearboxes, suspension. That was my start, and understanding how everything worked. Then my dad gave me the opportunity to drive the car a few races, then said, hey, I can't afford to keep doing this, even at the low level we were doing it, but there's the truck, there's the car, there's all the spare parts. Do with it whatever you want, but at the end of the day, it was his. And at that time, the Porsche was not very competitive, but the car had history. It won Sebring. So I asked him if I could sell it, and I sold it immediately to somebody in Italy, all right? Which later on, this guy that it sold it to became part of a great story. But we sell it. I knew a Roger Mandeville RX-7 was for sale.
Roger Mandeville.
Right, back in the day. I myself hopped in our little moving van truck, which is how we transported the car around, drove all the way to Greenville, Spartanburg, South Carolina, I think it was, which that becomes a BMW place later on. I picked up our RX-7. I picked up a spare engine, some spare bodywork, and I drove it home. Got home in our shop. I unload it, and there's this beautiful RX-7. There's the engines, and we're looking at them like it might as well have been a space shuttle. And we had no idea what this thing was going to do. So we couldn't afford to have people build the motors, the gearboxes, et cetera. So I called Damon Barnett, I think at the time was from Mazda Motorsports in Irvine. And I told him who I was. And we got this RX-7. And do you have a class, engine class? And he goes, I know who you are because he's seen me race a few times in the Porsche. And he says, we don't have a class. This doesn't exist. It's racing engines. But let me call you back. He calls me back like 2 hours later. He goes, how's Tuesday, Wednesday of next week? I said, perfect. What's going to happen? He goes, we'll send Fuji from Japan right to your shop.
Holy moly.
Take it apart, put it together. 2-day course. He'll do it for you. He's our latest engine guy. And we took it apart. We put it together. He spoke basically no English. I took notes. And when we were done, we put it on the dyno, and it was 352 horsepower, exactly what they said it was going to be. I put it on Clayton Cunningham's dyno, which they were, right? They raced Mazdas at the time. And that was our start in racing Mazdas. And at this time, I was a Porsche mechanic at a shop. And my Porsche mechanic buddies all worked at the same shop. And we became the Three Musketeers. These two guys and I basically were every race we went to, one hotel room. We trucked together. We flew together. Whatever it was, we did it together. And we got very potent at doing it. We got very good. We got fast. We actually made a breakthrough with a win in Elkhart Lake. And once that happened, we started winning and winning and winning. And it was expensive. If I ever got a phone call, you know, imagine I'm a 19-year-old kid or whatever. If I got a phone call, it was somebody I owed money to. It was this credit card company I owed money to.
Some things don't change, but okay.
I mean, all I knew was the dream was to race. Never was there even a thought about a career. It was not about a career. It was about the love of racing and carrying on what my dad had started. That was what was important to me. Very difficult. Broke, tough. Going, I would do fundraisers at my shop, and all our friends from the city would donate meat. We'd have barbecues, and they'd make donations, and we'd just keep going. Got Yokohama as a sponsor. At this time, Mazda had a contingency. If you finished 1, 2, 3, you actually got $5, $10, or $15,000. I mean, that was big bucks back then, right? And we got good enough. We went to Daytona. So imagine, I rented out 3 seats in Daytona in our car, which was a very good car, and I was over the moon when people would pay me $7,500 for a seat.
Wow.
$7,500 for, like, I could do everything. For 3 people with $7,500, I could run a 24-hour race, have new tires, and I'd be gone. Right? So that, look how times have changed. I could never do this again. So skip forward. I raced a few races for Mazda Factory. That didn't work out. Raced for Chrysler Factory. That deal folded. And I was, so then comes the Mazda back out again. And I think it was 1994, basically. And, you know, it got to be, was very hard. I called a guy. I forgot what his name was. And I remembered every once in a while. He was next to Eric Winsberg, not at BMW, but he worked for Milner. And Joe Weidensall, exactly. See, these are old names. And I called him and I said, look, you guys, and I knew BMW was struggling. They had not. So it was David Donahue, I think Pete Halsmer, maybe even John Paul Jr. was in there.
And this is also Bill Arbelin coming out of driving a Hawk World Sports Car, Atlantic driving exactly. Bill Arbelin. There was a guy who was reaching, searching
everywhere
for something at this time.
At some point, I had a 333 Ferrari that I even drove. A little bit, I mean, it was something was going to ignite, but I didn't know how. But I know I was going broke. I was broke. I mean, I was in debt. And something needed to happen. So, and I tried to be a very humble guy. That's like I want to be. I was always brought up that way. And I called Joe Weidensall and I said, listen, I know you guys are struggling. And I tried a new technique. I'll leave my Mazda behind. You guys put me in a car and you're going to win your first race. Like I was trying, like being a little bit.
Can I do a favor for you?
I'm going to do it. Look, so that's, I put it out there. So then I get a phone call back from Tom Milner. And he basically says, okay, how much? And I'm like, whoa. You can get paid in racing? Like, I had no idea that someone's going to get paid. So I don't remember what it was. I think it was like $2,500 plus expenses, right? So I was getting paid to go racing. I show up.
I'm surprised you didn't say me to you or you to me.
I couldn't believe it. When I heard those words, he has no idea. I was doing flips, right? I mean, everything starts somewhere, right? So we get to Texas World Speedway, and I'm so excited that I look at the Valvoline car or the First Union car. These were iconic cars. And I go over, I look for my name. It's not on that one, so I must be on the other one. So I go to the other one. It's not on that one. And I'm like, hold on. And they pull out a customer car from
Matt Cohen,
who later on became an Indy Lights owner, but a young kid, probably wealthy kid from New York.
Disqualified from some fine races.
Exactly. So he was just getting into racing, and they unroll a car out of the truck, and it's just a customer car. And there's my name on that car. So I go, oh, okay. So I'm not in the I'm in the kid's car. We're going to go racing. Turned out the car was very good. It was a late car, but it had a 3-liter engine. Didn't have a 3.2 liter engine in it. The new factory cars had the 3.2. So down the straights in Texas World, you stood no chance. And I actually asked Matt Cohen, I said, what happens? We're going to get killed.
Yeah.
If we don't get rid of this motor, what happens if it blows up? And he says, I don't know. I said, do they have another one? Yeah, I guess they have to give me one of theirs. I said, you got to get rid of this motor. And I've never actually done this in my life. And he goes, well, how do you do it? I said, shove it in every wrong gear you can. Poof, he blows the motor. 3.2 liter goes in.
This is the start of the career.
This is the start.
Race number one.
Get rid of that engine.
I'm surprised there was a number two.
No, they don't know the theme, right?
I understand.
Off we go. And now we are cooking with fire. This thing and I, it was a perfect match immediately. The BMW, the way it handled, the way it sent a feeling through me was perfect. And I think we got to qualifying. The diff broke. They had an issue with diffs breaking at this time, right? And the diff broke, so we started last. And from what I remember, I start the race. I pass the whole field. I'm leading the race. And this was the day when drivers could jump from car to car and get points in the car they start. And I guess behind the scenes, they were trying to talk Matt Cohen out of driving the car because it's leading the race, and I come in for the pit stop, and Pete Halsmer gets in, and not Matt Cohen, and I'm like, that is looking really good. I buckle in Pete Halsmer.
I mean, freaking Pete Halsmer. That's yeah.
And he goes, and he's on his way to victory, and I think just for the end, the diff breaks, they don't win, but that starts. And what was really neat was at that time, I think David Donahue was heading towards that North American Touring Car Championship.
Yeah.
And so it was going to open a seat, and he out me in, and that's how the whole thing started. We went then, I think, did we go, was the next race already Sears Point after that?
No, I was looking at the Lime Rock, then it was the Glen, then it was Sears Point.
Because then
we
went a couple races, and then we went 1, 2, 3 in Sears Point, and then we just started winning. Once they got that diff thing worked out, it was on to the races. And we set records after records, wins, championships, and everybody was happy.
So my Bill Arbelin theory of your formative days with BMW goes back to your RX-7 days. Not a crazy amount of power. Balance is important. Being able to massage everything out of this car with its overall abilities compared to a big motor or one big performance attribute. I've always thought that your mastery in an RX-7 directly applied to, you know, BMW models that, again, decent power, everything was good, but you really had to make all of those things work to get lap time out of it. Am I on
think
track or not?
Your spot, the early cars were not about power. They weren't about brute. It was about finesse and handling and manipulation. That's exactly right. Another thing that I think really helped me out was the fact that I came out of knowing every component on the car and how to build it intimately and understanding it. And so I'd be in the car and I'd have such mechanical sympathy to understanding parts that the instant I heard a noise or felt something, I knew exactly where to go, how to tell my engineers, and we could move very quickly with making fine-tuning, suspension, whatever changes we had to do. Those things really worked to my advantage.
So I don't want to delay too long before we start getting through some of the cool, amazing 399 that you've done with BMW, but I do want to explore just a little bit before we do that. So I've also been thoroughly convinced that because of your mechanical background, that you came into this brand as more or less a complete entity. Not just a driver. Turn the steering wheel, step on the little pedals, tell us what we want, get the F out of here. You're someone who is thinking constantly, knows how everything works, so whether it is the diagnosis you're doing, the relationships you have with the person taking care of the tires, engineer, at the factory, I have to believe, as a guy who, you know, busted his knuckles building things, assembling things, running things, you're able to connect on far more levels than most drivers fresh into a factory relationship. Is that accurate?
Totally right. I mean, you're spot on, even down to the point of where I was mapping engines on myself. So I would, when it came to traction control routines, I was writing the routines early on. Like, this was something we already had going. I already knew how to do it. So from one end, from when it came to the engine, to the suspension, to the brakes, I had a really good understanding. Everybody, and I told this, you know, later on in my career, Joey Hand came along, and I said, hey, Joey, you got to have a specialty that separates you from everybody else. And his became like dampers. He became the shock guy, and he focused on it, and it was something that he would always take precedent over somebody else. Mine was, like you said, understanding the mechanical aspect of a car as good as any one of my mechanics, basically, or my engineers, my electronic engineers. I try to understand it really well, and that connection has always been able to just eke me one little step ahead of a lot of other people. When their game is just driving, I actually knew how I could go back to something, manipulate it, get something more out of it, and eke just that much more out of it. And it could, I mean, I've been at the Yokohama tire factory on how a tire was built, to understand the cords, to understand everything that was on the ground, from, you name it, braking compounds, from every aspect of that car, and it's just trying to extract every tenth you can a different way. So
you launch your BMW career in what I refer to as North American sports car racing's wilderness period. 73 different championships. They're getting bought and sold on a daily basis. What's this called? It sounds a lot like the other one. Who runs this? Is this the good one? There's the European series that are coming over. This is kind of this big mishmash. And during that time, I saw a lot of drivers like yourself get aligned with the manufacturer, but because of the lack of clarity, this is pre-American Le Mans series, a lot of boom and bust, a lot of moving around, not a lot of loyalty either from the manufacturer to the driver or vice versa. What was this like for you, knowing that you have a manufacturer, you love this relationship, but you're starting this in an era where instability was kind of the thing? I mean, I would not have guessed we'd be talking about 400 bill based on the era that you came in with BMW.
You know, something that a lot of people don't let people into is there's something about drivers in this entire paddock, in the entire world, every single year, unless you have a contract that goes into next year, this is your last year until you make it happen for the next year. And it's this never-ending struggle. No matter how secure you think you are, you have to go back to the negotiating table, redo it again, do it again. You could be out the year your contract ends, and it's an unsettling feeling. So to be with BMW since 1995, I think that was my first year was 96. And this long means something between us really clicked. But every year you've always, like, going from last year to this year and this year to next year, you're always going to have to renegotiate your contract and try to get a few more years out of it and stay fast. I think ultimately the bottom line, you stay fast, you win races, and you don't make a mess out of things and you market well, then you're an asset to the company. As soon as you become a liability to the brand, everybody's going to be gone. They have no, I don't know if the loyalty extends past that. You got to be a good personality for the company, and you got to bring value to the brand.
I've heard he's okay at representing the brand. Wow. So,
but to that point, it's also him and his performance has never varied or gone down.
Yeah.
21 years. He's on, collectively, we're on Motorsport Manager 11 at BMW North America.
You've been through 11 BMW North America Motorsports managers.
Yeah. One of them twice.
Came back. Please. Boom. Larry Koch boomeranged it.
Larry Koch.
Yep.
But yeah, so that's, I mean, he's proven himself through 10.
Yeah. And a few presidents along the way too, right? I mean, so it's...
Yeah, like 4 or 5 anyway.
Yeah.
Jeez. He's going to be the future CEO here. We better be nice to him.
Exactly.
That'd be great.
The roach of BMW.
Never.
North America.
You can't get rid of him, right? But and you look at it like 21 years later, still winning races in GT Le Mans against kids that are the best, most refined drivers you ever see in the world. So I mean, it's still going.
Hi to our families at home.
Yeah, right.
So, looking at your early BMW days, the diversity of things that you got to drive that were BMW powered were pretty awesome as well. Now, again, you came into your relationship having driven a lot of things. Done crazy races in Japan with IMSA. I mean, it's not as if you were hurting for cool experiences, but it seems to me that going to Le Mans and a McLaren F1, BMW-powered Riley prototypes, and on top of the GT stuff, which you're so heavily associated with, you got to drive some pretty cool, iconic things, too. Tell me about some of those opportunities, what it's like hearing that V12 shriek behind you for hours, you know, heading down the Mulsanne. I mean, good Lord, man, that's fantasy stuff.
Oh, it's the first time I drove the McLaren Longtail, right? So imagine this is a V12 that sounds, like, amazing. And I got the opportunity to go to Le Mans. Finally, this whole thing came together. I needed a Le Mans experience. Well, I guess I'm going to do it in a McLaren Longtail. I'm thinking... It's incredible.
98, right?
98, right? And I go barreling down the Mulsanne. It's nighttime. And I just remember this experience. I remember the experience. I'm going down pit lane, and you're on the pit speed limiter, but you have hot tires. So the moment you release, you are full tilt and off you go. And people are hanging over the pit exit wall. And I could, and it's like they're hanging there, and I released a button and off I go. I thought, nothing sounds cooler than this. I'm just getting gears, and I'm going. Then I go down the Mulsanne. And I think you go into, like, Indianapolis and through there, and you're downshifting, and you could see the reflection of the flames coming off the barriers and stuff. And, you know the brakes are glowing, and you hear this motor, and I go, I swear to God, when I drive this car, I am better looking, I'm taller, and I have more hair. There's no question about it. I'm way cooler in this car. And it was an experience that I got to drive the short-tail McLaren last week or something, and it brings back all those memories. When you hear it, you're just like, this is one of the coolest cars ever. Do they get faster? Yeah. Do they get much cooler? Probably not. Have I made mistakes in racing? Yeah. I'll give you an example of a mistake in racing. Was, I think, Auto Week magazine or something. So that was the EMI record car.
Yep.
And now it's totally passé.
Steve, I forget his
name. Steve O'Rourke.
That's right.
He owned EMI. Yep. He was the manager of Pink Floyd, right? So that car is now done because prototypes have gone to LMR. So all the Toyota crazy stuff, that car's done. It all of a sudden it shows up in Auto Week a few months later for sale. And my dad goes, oh, look, the car you raced in Le Mans for sale. And I think it was like $275. And I go, why? Who would buy
pay
this car?
That much money
this
for
this car is useless. I'm like, I'm ready to just kill one. Now what are they, $15, $16 million, something like that for the long tail? Just done. $275. I'm like, nobody would buy this car.
We'd be having this conversation on your G5 right
now. Exactly. I'm like, do not ever come to me for financial advice. Shoot. So that's something I regret, that I couldn't start, you know, like put that away and keep it. I remember I was in, I think, Kitzbühel, Austria. BMW always has a motorsports banquet. And BMW says we have something to display and show you, and it's snowing outside. And everybody goes outside, and all of a sudden you hear, wong, 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 this car comes up in the snow. And I'm like, what is this thing? And it is Tom Christensen in the LMR, in the kind of coming in the rain tires, in the snow, in front of everybody. And I thought, oh, my God, This is the neat. The design was amazing. If you remember the LMR, the design was with the new roll bar.
Absolutely.
And how low it was, the sleek. It was the best looking car I've ever seen. See you, Bob.
Hi, Bob.
Marsh.
Good to see you, brother.
I'm not interrupt your
interview. No, not. Hey, we're sitting in your trailer, brother. We appreciate it. Thank you.
And really, the car shows up, and I think, and this is the best thing I've ever seen in my life. It's beautiful. It's a work of art. So then we go back into the banquet, and they want it. They're making announcements and giving their awards away and blah, blah. At the end of the night, they make the announcement of who's on the Motorsports Drivers Campaign, whatever. And they announce for who's going to drive the LMR, and it was J.J. Leto, Jorg Muller, and Smoking Joe Winklehawk. And then my name comes up. I had not even a shred of clue. I'm like,
that didn't sound like M3. There's.
I'm like, check please, and I just want to run away and not let them write their mistake. I thought, I flew out of there the next day, and I just didn't want to hear that they were just kidding or something. And that's how that deal, the LMR, started. And sure enough, I drove it in America, and it was incredible.
So tell me about that. So, again, this barking, amazing 12-cylinder motor, cool, cool prototype. Also, a really cool era as we're coming into the late 90s, early 2000s with the American Le Mans series really becoming a foundational series. We also get some other German friends coming over to compete in prototype. Tell me about representing BMW in this prototype, but also having some fierce competition, right? Because it's not just driving the car, it's knowing you've got to knock off some pretty serious competition. Oh, yeah. How much did you enjoy that? Did you take to the prototypes easily?
Yeah, I mean, they probably in every car, there's somebody that's just the best, right? And I think Leto was, he was incredible. He could really, he was a master of that car. Just like in GT, in certain cars, I've had my day, and now I think Alexander Sims is incredible now, right? But when I got in that car, I took to it. It was great when we first got it. And I think one of my first races in that car was Mosport. And it wasn't Mosport. It was one of the first races. I don't know why I remember that.
I think in the LM.
LM was here.
Yeah, the LMR, Sears Point, 99, at least on the list here.
Okay. So I remember when we drove that car, it was a similar motor to the McLaren, but the way the car, I don't know if it was lighter or what, but it was ferocious. And at the time, there was nothing that was going to stand in our way. It was cutting edge. It was a guided missile. It was meant to go fast in a straight line. That's what it was built for. And when you pointed that thing straight, it never stopped accelerating. You pull gears. I drive it today, and you step on that accelerator, and you're like, wow, this is impressive.
We can hear you laughing just from joy going by.
It's not laughing. You hang on because it's just going and pulling and pulling. And I remember there was a point at which the motor made so much torque that it was unusable by the drivers. So we asked, please, could we redirect the power band? Take it away and put it up on top.
Laptop Bill doing
not
the
me.
Mapping
not me.
Again.
That was so later on in my career. It gets to be so technical now with all these guys. They don't let you touch a thing. Mm. You have very little input other than just your driver reports. That's how the boating thing kind of started because
yes.
I needed to be able to do something, right? And so, like, get your creative juices going.
The time I visited you at your shop with that boat, you were, elbows deep, and it was just cool seeing you with this. You know, here's this giant thing that you have to master, and everything's really extreme. And it was just that was another cool manifestation of someone with this kind of endless technical curiosity.
And that's that's what did it. I mean, I designed the outdrive that's on the back. That's why I even did the whole project. Makes my own transmissions now. Designed it from the ground up. And I mean, but the motorsports, knowing what the best is able to be, and then taking it over to a different industry that doesn't even have a concept at the time of what is capable and being able to utilize all that stuff. It was pretty neat. So that was fun for me.
Let's move forward just a little bit into the early 2000s, something in a series that I worked in, and in the couple of times that I ran cars in the turn car class, you whooped our behinds. Your relationship with Will Turner, Turner Motorsport, there are some beautiful yellow and blue BMWs that you have used to whip the living heck out of people in. tell me about that relationship, because this is someone who's a premier tuner, aftermarket person, you know, really fits into that BMW universe of wanting to satisfy the needs of customers. What was it like getting into World Challenge then, which wasn't an American Le Mans series, wasn't 24 Hours of Le Mans, so I don't know where it would fall in the professional grade, but man, that was some pretty stiff competition.
It was, and it was a good time, and it was really fun, because Will, they were kind of new to it all. I don't know where I'd even place them, because they were not PTG. PTG was factory
monster
team, but they were creative, and they were inventive and resourceful. You know, Will's always been kind of that way. And then when I was still racing for PTG at the time, so I could bring a lot of the new stuff that we were always coming up with and tell them the idea, and then he would backdoor it out of BMW and get it this way.
Have you guys seen the gearbox for the
car? Exactly. I don't know.
Right? Don't look in the trunk.
So,
we're fine.
So somehow we would be getting these new touring intakes or all the latest stuff. Will would be getting it. And it was a pretty cool time. It was with me and a guy named Mark Feinstein was the – I don't know if you ever met that guy, but he was the crew chief, and he worked very hard. And – we had success, and then we started winning races. I think we had a very good car. You know, you need a good car.
Yeah.
But we had a good car. We had a good team, good reliability. And what was so neat about that championship, I think, I don't exactly remember. I won it, and then maybe I did both championships at the same time. So then we came back, and I think I won that one again, but I didn't. The GT one that we were doing with the PTG car, I lost it right at the very end, basically. We were in Road Atlanta. We were in a dead heat race with Randy Pobst and the Audi. And an axle broke right at Road Atlanta. That hurt us in the points. We finished second. Otherwise, we would have maybe been able to win both championships. But great time with Will. That started the Will relationship. That went on for a lot of races and a lot of success. I couldn't always experience a championship with my teammates because I might have to miss a race to run my factory deal. But, you know, Justin, Paul Dallana, I think Justin Marks, a lot of these guys won championships that were my teammates. And it was fun to know that I helped these guys in winning championships.
So at the same time, you're also driving. There was this pretty cool BMW effort with the M3 GTR. And I remember hearing all the complaints about the what engines in it, etc. And I'm going, look, friends, we're here to see awesome, not to worry about homologation papers. And we have amazing drivers coming over, whether it's those of the yodeling variety or you name it. Just that era to me is really special as well, where you've got Pro Drive and their Ferrari 550s coming in and the Corvettes. I mean, tell me about that era too, because we're so used to massive GT Le Mans style competition today, but maybe folks forget it was pretty fierce back in the early 2000s.
It really was. When that GTR came out, it rewrote the books on what a GT car could be. I mean, there were times that, no question, I thought we could beat the Corvettes. That's how good we were, and we would hold back. That's how much we had in our pocket. We knew it. The problem was we had this incredible car, but we had four of them. Should have been two of them. We had Schnitzer, and we had PTG. And when you try to put two roosters in the hen house, I don't think it works out. And all we looked at was across the aisle to beat Schnitzer, and all they looked at was across the aisle to beat us. And it became, we should have been holding back and just doing it the right way, and it became a war to beat these guys. So much so that we get to Petit Le Mans when we finally go to that GTR with the Stars and Stripes car. And it was a good and bad day, because it's coming off of 9/11. We didn't even know if we were going to do the race, so we decided we're going to do it as a tribute, you know, and put the Stars and Stripes on as an honor to the people that suffered great tragedy through that event. And there we are racing this race, and it turns out we are leading this race, and we're doing very – we had Yokohamas, they had Michelins, and we're leading it, and we're going to win it, barring any error. There's still – anything can go wrong in a race. And we get to the end of the race. Not only did Tom Milner want to win – this is the kind of guy Tom Milner is. He wanted to win that race, and he won a fast lap. He didn't care if it happened in the last hour of this. He puts on a sticky set of tires, and he goes, get that fast lap. We could have thrown this thing in the ditch five different ways, but he wanted fast lap, and he won the race win. I mean, and that's how we ended the Stars and Stripes and the GTR, which there was a time in Sebring we did a 158 in that car when we unleashed it a little bit. That was a capability of this car. Was that 2000, right?
Yes.
There are times now when you race in the Z4 era, just a few years back, a 58 would be a challenge. right? That's how far ahead that car was. It was, the engine was a work of art, I think designed by the F1 engine designer. So you could seriously go and take it and pick it up. It was 200 and something pounds. Jeez. That's how light and low. And it's as if the guy said, how much power can that tire handle at 80 miles an hour? And if you said 440, he gives it 439. It was right on the edge.
Wow.
The entire power band up. It was like perfection coming off of turns. With you just put your foot down, and it was this linear, perfect power plant. Sounded amazing. I still drive it. We still have it. So every once in a while I get to drive it, and it is an incredible sounding car.
So we're looking at, we're getting into BMW races, 130, 40, 50, 2005, 2006 era, that era in general. Tell me about that time, Bill, where it seemed to me that obviously you're championship focused in wherever you are being asked to, you know, commit full time, but it also seemed to be a point in time where BMW realized, this guy's our ringer. We can send him to go do what today would be a Continental Tire Series race in Grand Am. We can send him World Challenge, ALMS, wherever it is. If there is a race of value for us, or maybe a couple races, we want extra points in the championship. What was it like recognizing that, wow, I can be many things for them, not just one car, one championship, you know, really have the blinders on? Is that something you liked, appreciated?
Never even thought about it.
Really?
Just, I mean, as much as they would send me to a race, I would be almost, I wouldn't say begging them, but wanting to experience that race for that team, whether it was for Schubert in Dubai or wherever they would send me, I'd be clawing to go and do that race because I'd love new experiences. I want to win everywhere I go. You know, that's the objective. So just if I could make the sheet even bigger with wins in different places, that's the objective. I guess it's nice to know that they know you won't go and make a mess out of, you know, like they can plug you in and they can turn their head and know the car's going to come back and be in good shape and maybe have a chance to win. If anybody's going to win it, maybe he's going to win it, you know? So I guess that's nice to know.
All right. I'm going to mash the throttle a little bit here. So if we're looking at celebrating numbers, 400 Petit Le Mans, start 200 for BMW, Watkins Glen, 2007, Siegel Sport, BMW O'Reilly. I don't know if a Daytona prototype is necessarily what we would have considered for the halfway mark of your 400, but
yeah.
Not sure if history will look back on Daytona prototypes as God's greatest prototype creation, but was that something you could sink your teeth into? Did you enjoy that? Were there series of cars that you're asked to drive where you're like, all right, this is where I'm earning my money. I'm just going to shut up and turn the wheel?
Nope. No, I don't think so. I don't think there's I mean, Daytona's great fun. And if you look at the depth in that field, that was a deep field. I mean, by the time you clawed your way up to the front, you were Angelelli, Scott Pruitt. Mm. You know, you had a lot of great guys up there. And I had to work my way from the back all the way to the front and get there. And that is still, the other day, I'm redecorating my shop office. And I hold that trophy and I look at it. And it has a lot of meaning to me, actually.
Wow.
Because it's something that I watch the video of the pass every once in a while. I listen to the excitement of the announcers as they go and talk about it. And I wish there was more racing like that. I enjoyed that. At first when Daytona prototypes came out, it was a little odd. They hadn't quite got their way. But I think during that time, they had 25 probably car fields, and they had 20 that could do really well. So it was fun.
So we're sitting here in the BMW Team RLL trailer. Your relationship with the RLL side started along with BMW. 2009. Interesting that we're still here. Great continuity there as well. What has this relationship been like with this team and this manufacturer come together? Because there have been championships earned. There's been a lot of kickassery going on, different cars, different models. Kind of cool to see someone as a constant in this relationship as well.
I mean, when I came in, it's like the game got upped almost a little bit. When you come to Ray Hall, they're coming down from IndyCars, which is the highest level of racing there is in America, basically. And I'm sinking myself into a whole, it's like an engineering experience. I mean, these guys, they have five engineers in the front office at the time and very specific shock guys. I mean, this was very, very high tech. And it was as good a team. It took a little while for everybody to gel. But what was so neat about it is when you got a guy like Bobby, Bobby doesn't, he doesn't operate it as a team owner. He operates as a, he understands it from a driver aspect. He can be in the pit stand, and while he's watching the race unfold, he understands mentally what you're going through and how to get the most out of you. And it's really neat to hear the words that he says, when to put your head down, when to push, when to pull back. You know, he knows it from a driver, a very successful driver perspective. So it's great from that side. I've had some incredible engineers come and go. So
that was another thing I wanted to ask about as well, because that, not every driver will admit that they're half of the true performance capabilities of a car.
I mean, without these guys in this truck, if we get back to PTG, these were the guys that started it all for me. And then you get here, and, you know, there's a lot of guys, you know, the Jay O'Connells. I mean, these guys were masterminds behind the scene. Jim Prescott, you know, he was here, and sadly he's no longer with us. This was a guy that could see the future unfolding during a race. You know, like, he could see it, and he'd be like, pit now, and he would know that a crash was about to happen, and he would put us from the back to the front constantly. He was a legend for this. I mean, I miss him a lot. And so many great guys on this team that work tirelessly, super hard. And like you said, I'm the small component at the end that could just screw it up. And these are the guys that really make it happen. If you look at my cars, knock on wood, historically, my crew guys never make a mistake. And how can you say that about a crew? It'd be years to go back where you see that they've done something that ever cost a problem. You know, I mean, it almost never happened. That's how perfect they are. So whatever method they're using, they're that good.
Let's close on picking. Remke?
Scott Remke. Sorry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Sorry.
I'm still sorry.
Yeah.
We wish you.
Sorry. Yeah. I said. Oh, yeah. Scott. This is.
You said Jim.
Sorry.
That's okay.
Sorry.
We absolutely love and miss Scott for sure.
There you go.
So let's close your choice, your selection on this ridiculous list of 399 starts coming into Petit Le Mans. One or two or three, whatever it is, a couple of Bill Arberlin BMW races, whether it's defying gravity through the air, whether it's a major victory, a personal moment, something where you go, there are a couple, I'm sure, that mean weighted a little more heavy than the other ones.
Shoot. First Daytona win. You know, the Daytona win when you have actual blood on your car from the crew guys. You ever remember? There was a time we're racing the car, and the windshield cracked from going up the bank at the time, and it cracked and cracked. It got worse and worse and worse. Then we have an onboard camera, and eventually the windshield is sinking in at full speed. And what was the guy?
Tommy Hessert.
And he's holding the window out.
Oh.
And they're telling Tom Miller, "You got to come in. Your windshield's here." No, there's nothing wrong. We see it on TV. He's holding the
camera.
Hessert's a maniac.
Yeah, and he's holding it out, and he's still leading. We had a couple-lap lead. That was those days, right? So that the car comes in, and Dave Gahagan, my guys, Brian Krem, they rip this windshield out with their bare hands, some gloves, and they put a new one in. We still go. We win by, like, very little margin. And when the car's in victory lane, you look, and there's still their blood around the window frame. And that's about as hardcore as it gets to their dedication to winning races. When you win... and you can look across the table, and it's an effort that was a monumental effort. Those are the best ones, you know. One of my fun races, it was not in a BMW, but it was 1995 in a Porsche in Sebring, because it was my dad's 10-year anniversary to winning. And I did it for Alex Job, right, at the time. But It's a piece of history that my dad and I have in common. He's got the 1985 trophy, and I got the 1995 trophy. And that's a pretty neat race, too. But then it becomes this blur of the three colors of BMW and the Rondel. That's all you just remember bits and pieces of wins and wins and wins and great races side by side and rubbing and pushing and It's been a great career for a lot of years now.
I feel like we're overlooking one race, which probably is the embarrassment of those 399. That's driving for a guy named Marshall Pruitt at Thunder Hill in the 25 hours at Thunder Hill in 2006. I've talked to BMW. We're trying to race that, find something else we might have forgotten, so you have 399 going into 400 reel. But all kidding aside, let's just close on the future. You're going to get to 400. I don't know what you're going to end on. 5, 6, I don't know. Usually when you get to a point where you're not producing, you do have that concern, am I going to get a contract for next year?
Yeah.
We look at Scott Pruitt at 97 years old, and we look at Hurley Haywood, who was driving at 403 years old.
Yeah.
If you're producing, if you're still there, is this something where you're saying, don't give me an end date. I'm going to, as long as they ask me back, I'll be here. Is that in your blood?
Oh,
or do you
sure.
see a point where you go, going to the farm, going to ride horses?
No. I want to, racing's in my blood. I mean, I could end my life, end my career here, and this is what I was designed and built to race a car. This is all I know. This is my love now, right? And as like you said, as long as you're producing, it's satisfying to me. If I can no longer do that, then I got to take a different role, but I still would like it to be at the racetrack.
Bill Arbelin, freaking American hero, whether you like it or not.
I'll force it down your throat.
Yes.
If I have to. That's it.
Like it or not.
Like it or not.
You're amazing. We're going to say positive things, whether you whether go you F yourself.
Choke yourself with Bill Arbelin. Oh, God.
Well, congratulations, brother.
Thank you.
Cool.
And the only reason the Marshall Pruitt race didn't come up is because my car, I had to watch that other car almost win the race. Our sister car, by the way, was Joey Hand running that car. But another moment in dedication is our engine blew up early on the race. And most teams would just pack it away. You guys switched the engine out, and we ran the whole race again. So that gives you an idea. Dedication people are willing to do for the sport. It's kind of crazy.
This guy is giving me advice on the pit wall, I think, while that engine change is going on. And meanwhile, I'm truly looking to see if any of the Northern California hillbillies have brought a shotgun so I can kill myself.
No.
Losing a motor the first hour of a 25-hour race. And this guy over here, where I'm like, you know, I've had a great career, done a lot of stuff, but this is early in my life being a team owner. And Bill frickin' Arbelin, and I've just let this guy down. He had every right to go, Pruitt, you are a piece of garbage. I'm yelling at whomever at BMW told me to come out here. Instead, this guy becomes a cheerleader. So it's just one of those things where you go, this could have gone the opposite way, and I would have had to have taken it, and he would have been 100% correct. But instead...
No way, that's not what it is. Heck
well,
no.
How's this? I've seen that other way.
Oh, that's bad.
In many forms, where folks are very entitled and feel as if you exist to fulfill their fantasies.
Oh.
Yeah, so having you and Joey, etc., just like, we'll get through it.
We did. It's close.
So let me ask you a question. So one thing you haven't done yet, is it all-time victories?
Yeah, that's the last thing on the list. All-time victories. I mean, if I could, I had three more, and I got the most wins of any person. That is
yeah,
true.
Because you never think about it, but you go look at, hey, who's got all-time pole winner? It's you.
I mean, I've won Daytona twice. I've won Sebring three times. I've won every race on the circuit multiple times. It's time. Like, if I could, Scott Pruitt. I mean, the guy's amazing, obviously. But if I could get three more wins, I think this was three more wins, right?
Three more.
And I almost had it in VIR. I can't believe we lost that one. I had a tire go flat 8 minutes from the end or whatever it was. That killed me. But these, as you know, these wins in this championship, they're getting harder and harder and harder and harder and harder. So you get one, you've won against the best and the brightest and the fastest. So.
Well, I'm just going to say this in all honesty. You're driving a BMW. You will get there. He's driving a Lexus. And on that, we're going to close.
Thanks.
Bill Arbelin, once again. Thank you, brother.
And that was Bill Arbelin at 400 with BMW. You can get every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast on iTunes. I also happen to post each episode right when it goes up on our Facebook page, Marshall Pruitt Podcast. So that's where you can get all the goodness there. Much like Bill is coming up to and hitting 400, we are just a couple of podcasts away from hitting the 200 mark. with our little after hours project here. So hope you enjoy this. Bill's just, he's just the man. And love the guys at BMW too. They have a heck of a lot of character and spirit. And even if you might not naturally associate those things with a major German corporation, I can tell you that at least on the motorsports side, these folks have a great way of going about things, know how to have fun, and also know how to celebrate those like Bill, who helped deliver pretty cool things for them. All right, I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thanks for listening.